bana bemtende ni ayibona lempi ilalele
ilalela bafana bemtende
we bafana siyenze
asipusheni lempi sishonze
we bafana bemtende ni ayibona lempi
ilalele ilalela bafana bemtende
Weba fana siyenze njani
Asipusheni lempi sishonze
Ho siyenze njani
Asipusheni lempi sishonze
Ho siyenze njani
Asipusheni lempi sishonze
Baza kushaya Baza kushaya fana ukepenenda Baza kushaya Baza kushaya fana ukepenenda
Fulu, Igbo, Swahili, Hausa, Arabic. Those are just a few of the over 2,000 languages spoken in Africa. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. My guest is Katrina Daly Thompson, who goes by KD, an F.U. Bascom professor in the humanities, professor of religious studies, and director of the doctoral program in second language acquisition at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Their books include Papabawa, Tanzanian Talk, Swahili Learner's Reference Grammar, Muslims on the Margins, and Zimbabwe's Cinematic Arts. Today, we celebrate African languages. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you so much.
Can you tell me a little bit about what drew you into this area of study?
Sure. I did my undergraduate study at Grinnell College in Iowa, a small liberal arts college. And while I was there, I started studying African literature. I was an English major. And then had the good fortune to spend a semester abroad in Zimbabwe. And ironically, I chose a program where I thought I didn't need to know a second language in order to go.
That's ironic.
So because Zimbabwe was a former British colony, I thought I could get by with English. But the program ended up having a really strong Shona component, which is the major language of Zimbabwe. And that was my first positive language learning experience. And I got really hooked on language learning and especially on African languages. So then I ended up coming here to graduate school in the late 90s to focus on Shona and eventually added Swahili to my repertoire as well and later got involved in African language teaching.
One of the Wisconsin Public Radio guests that I worked with a lot in the past was the late Harold Shoib, legendary teacher on the UW campus who traveled throughout Africa with a tape recorder,
yes.
recording stories and languages. And did he have any influence on sort of your fascination with languages?
Yeah, a bit. He was still a faculty member here when I was a graduate student. And though we didn't work on the same languages, he focused mainly on Southern Africa, mainly South Africa. But certainly he was an inspiration in terms of someone who could become fluent in many African languages late in life. So I appreciated that example, and it was definitely inspirational to me.
When I see the numbers, and I know they vary, you know, where some places will say it's 1,000, some will say it's over 2,000, maybe 3,000 languages. But when I see that number, it seems overwhelming.
It is.
Can you give us some sense of the scope? And I also saw that in Nigeria alone, there's over 500 languages.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the numbers in Nigeria specifically, but in Tanzania, where I do most of my work, there's 120. So, yeah, most countries have large numbers, and 2,000 seems to be the most widely recognized estimate for the continent as a whole. But again, it depends on how you define language versus dialect. So a lot of these languages were identified and labeled by colonialist linguists, and sometimes they would call something a dialect when others might call it a language or vice versa. So there's a lot of variation in terms of how we can actually count languages, but it's definitely one of the most diverse continents linguistically.
Why is that?
Well, probably because that's where humans first evolved, and so there's just a lot of diversity in various ways in terms of language, in terms of ecology, and so on.
But if you have within a fairly small geographic region a lot of different languages, not just dialects, but languages. Is it because there were more geographic features that kept groups apart, or is it because There were also different, it was more focused on a smaller community, a sort of extended family structure, or it seems if you have a bunch of people living in a sort of similar area, there would be a merging of languages. But it doesn't seem to have happened in a lot of places.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not really sure of the historical reasons for that. You might have to ask a historical linguist rather than a sociolinguist.
One thing that has struck me with the many African students that I've worked with in the Odyssey Project is that they may be coming to English as their fourth, fifth, or sixth mm-hmm. language because maybe they had a indigenous language or, you know, an original language, such as, for example, Moray in Burkina Faso. Then they learned French and then, maybe Swahili and mm-hmm, then English. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That there's a tradition of multiple languages.
Yeah, that's right. I have read that most Africans will claim that they know about five languages on average. And one thing that I find interesting that I work on with my students is that this, what it means to know a language can vary quite a bit. So many Africans will claim knowledge of a language that they can only use in certain settings. Maybe they use that for trading, or as they use a different language for religious purposes and a different language at home and so on. So one activity I often do with students at the beginning of a class focused on African languages is to ask them how many languages they speak or which languages they speak, but for them to include a language even when they know only a few words in it. And then you find that even American students are actually more multilingual than they might normally admit or recognize in themselves.
If they know a song in French or right. to count in Spanish or right. whatever. How many of the languages that are included in that sort of guess at 2,000 languages, how many of them are spoken only and not written?
Oh, I'm not sure. That's a good question.
But this, I assume it would include kind of a mixture of both those that are
yes.
not written down and those that
yes.
are.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of languages have been written down, as I mentioned, because of like early colonialist linguists. But, you know, as I mentioned, those differences between language and dialect might mean that only one dialect was chosen as the standard and others have never been written down and so on. For Shona, for example, early linguists chose one dialect or kind of an amalgamation of several dialects to create a standard form out of five or six, and the others have not been written down. But people, one advantage, at least with Bantu languages, is that they've, which includes like Shona and Swahili, Zulu, and so on, many of the Southern African languages, is that they were generally written down phonetically, so that if someone learns to read and write one of them, it's fairly easy to learn to read and write another one, or just to, you know, to write a letter, for example, in your own native language, even if you weren't formally taught to read and write that language in school.
Well, let's start with Shona, because it sounds like that's the language that you first worked
yes.
in.
Yes.
Can you speak something in Shona and
sure.
then talk about it? Because I think, you know, we're used to, with English, sort of seeing commonalities with French and German mm-hmm. and Italian and Spanish mm-hmm. and all that. So, you know, but in the case of African languages, for those of us who do not know any African language, it's harder to sort of picture what the differences are from mm-hmm. what we're used to.
Yeah. So Bantu languages are a language family where you see a lot of similarities across them the same way you might see across Romance languages.
And what countries would you find Bantu languages being spoken the most?
Mostly throughout Southern Africa and a little bit in Southwest Africa, Cameroon and south of there, primarily. So the grammar of these languages, they have a very complex noun class system. So when we talk about French, for example, we refer to nouns being masculine, feminine, and neuter. Bantu languages have up to 21 noun classes instead of those three, or
oh, wow.
21 genders.
I thought it was hard enough
say.
In German. I know in German you have different gender for fork, knife, and spoon.
Yes.
And it doesn't necessarily match what French does right. with their masculine, feminine. So you're
right.
saying, so if there's an object, you could choose from over 20 different
Well, each object would have its own noun class. So, for example, I'll start with Swahili, actually, because my Swahili is more proficient than my Shona at this point. So in Swahili, you would have most words for people would be in the first noun class. So you would, and they would start with the letter M or the sound mu. So you would find mtu for person, or in some dialects, mutu, which, and then you would find a very similar word for person in many other Bantu languages. And then the plural would be in a different noun class. So you would say watu. So mtu moja, one person, watu wawili, two people. And then class three would be often things, plants. So mti would be a tree, or muti in some dialects or some other Bantu languages. And then the plural starts with mi, so miti. So that's class four. And then class five are often abstract nouns. So jambo is a concern or a thing, an abstract thing. And then the plural starts with ma, mambo. So jambo, mambo. And then class seven and eight are more concrete things, and they start with ki and vi. So kitu, a thing, vitu, things. And then class 9 and 10 would be, again, more abstract nouns, often words that are borrowed from other languages. So we find things like motoka for a car, and it would be the same in the singular and plural. And then class 11 is for, some people say long, thin objects. So ukuta, a wall. And then the plural would be in a different class. And then class 14 is for very abstract things like love. So upendo. And those usually start with u or wa. And then it goes on for locations and so on. So you have this very complex system where the typically there's a noun prefix that will give you a hint as to what noun class it's in, and then to some extent these overlap with sort of categories of meaning, though that can be not always accurate. That kind of confuses students sometimes when they get too attached to those abstract categories, then try to put words in different classes based on that rather than based on their morphological structure.
And can you just talk for a bit in Swahili? Just tell us about languages, maybe, or yourself or something else, so we hear it sort of more as a flowing language.
Jina langu ni KD kwa Kiingereza au Zuhura kwa Kiswahili. Nimesoma Kiswahili kwa miaka mingi, zaidi ya miaka 20, na sasa mimi ni profesa katika chuo kikuu cha Wisconsin Madison.
Well, I got the professor in the Wisconsin Madison in there. And if someone heard you speak who knew Swahili from birth on, would they hear you as talking with an American version of Swahili? And if so, how would that show
I think
show
they
up?
Would definitely know that I'm not a native speaker, but I'm not sure that I sound particularly American.
And what is the, you know, sometimes with languages, there are certain letters that are difficult for somebody coming in from a different language, or certain grammatical features, or you know, it can be whether there's an article or not, whether there's confusion between two sounds. What is the biggest difference? Like with Swahili, what are the features that make it different than English?
Besides the noun class system is a major one. The other is that it's, like most Bantu languages, considered an agglutinative language, which means that it takes many parts of speech and puts them together into one word. So, for example, if you wanted to say, I love you, you would say, Nina kupenda. It's all one word. So the ni at the beginning means I, the subject marker. The na means present tense. Ku means you. And then penda is the verb root, love. So that's another feature that is very different from English. Let's see, what are some of the, adjectives come after the noun rather than before.
So instead of saying instead of a beautiful day, you'd say a day beautiful?
Mm-hmm. So siku njema.
Okay. And are there some untranslatable things? I know with my father being a native speaker of German, there's certain words that, you know, where he'll still use the German because it's hard to find something mm-hmm. that's quite the same as Gemütlichkeit or whatever it is. There's some words that don't translate as well. With Swahili, are there words where you really can't find an English equivalent?
I'm sure there are, but I'm not sure if I can come up with one off the top of my head.
And I guess another related question is, if no one spoke Swahili, or if that language went extinct, what would we lose? Because sometimes language and culture go right together, and contained within a language is also religious traditions or values or ways of viewing the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of Swahili's major features is that it's become a lingua franca throughout East Africa, which, you know, on the one hand means it's not likely to ever go extinct, but also means that if it did, people throughout that region would lose the ability to communicate across different ethnic groups. As you mentioned earlier, this idea of having a lot of different languages within one area can be a challenge to creating a sense of community and national identity and so on. And Swahili has really enabled that to happen, particularly in Tanzania, but also to some extent in Kenya and Uganda. So that would be a really major loss, I think, for people in that region. In terms of Swahili culture specifically, most Swahili native speakers are Muslim, and that's a really important part of their culture as well as their language and so on. Even when you asked about untranslatable words, a lot of that I think has to do with Islam and just kind of the challenge of understanding Islam fully from a Western perspective. I think a lot of that is really captured in the vocabulary that Swahili has borrowed from Arabic. And kind of Swahiliized in a number of ways. So that would also be a big loss.
So when you say Swahiliized, are we talking about a kind of the way we say Spanglish, where it's a Spanish-English thing? Are you saying that Arabic and something like Swahili sometimes come, that there's a merging or a
There
mixture?
Is a lot of Arabic vocabulary in coastal Swahili, which is the dialect that standard Swahili was derived from. So people estimate about 40% of the vocabulary on the coast is borrowed from Arabic, mainly for concepts that were brought by Arab traders. So things like Islam, having to do with trade and business and so on, there's a lot of vocabulary borrowed from Arabic. But if you go farther inland to the areas of East Africa that had less contact with the Arab world, you find less of that kind of influence of Arabic.
Let's listen to a popular song in Swahili and then talk about it. You can talk about the language we're hearing in this song.
Jambo, jambo bwana, habari gani, nzuri sana, wageni, mwakaribishwa, Kenya yetu, hakuna matata.
So in this Jambo
Buana
song, tell us what they're saying. It's
sure.
a great song, but I have no clue what the words mean.
So the title Jambo Buana means hello, sir. And Jambo is kind of a tourist version of a common Swahili greeting. So the more standard version would be hujambo, si, and then the response is si jambo. So literally it's like, you don't have any problems, do you? No, I don't have any problems. But because in the standard form, you have the grammar changes, whether you're the initiator or the responder. Tourists kind of have trouble with that grammar, so it's been shortened to Jambo. And a lot of people, especially in Kenya, who work with tourists, have kind of adopted that tourist form as a more popular greeting. And so this song talks about basically welcoming visitors to East Africa. So it says, Wageni Wakaribishwa, guests are welcomed. So again, we find this agglutinative form of they are welcomed, all in one verb.
And with the use of a phrase like a Hakuna Matata, which brings up, you know, echoes of Lion King and so
yes.
on. Can you tell us something about that phrase? That is one of those phrases that's kind of been lifted
yes.
out of a show and kind of into common discourse. You can find it in Disney.
Yes.
You
know? So Hakuna Matata literally means there are no problems. And you could use it as a response to any kind of greeting where people are asking you how you're doing. It's not really a common phrase the way the Lion King made it out to be. But one of my students who's from Kenya brought me back a sign, a wooden carving that says Hakuna Matata that I have hanging in my office. So it is at least something that's kind of sold in markets, probably more for tourists than for locals. But I'm grateful when I first started teaching Swahili about 20 years ago, that generation who was in college then were those who grew up with the Lion King. And so I had a lot of students who told me that's why they were interested in studying Swahili.
That's interesting. We'll be back in a moment with more sampling of African languages. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Katie Thompson, and we are talking about African languages. Can you give us a sense of what it's like if you are a student wanting to learn some of these 2,000 languages and you go to a traditional college, whether it's Grinnell, where you did your undergraduate, or here at the UW-Madison? What are your options for studying languages?
Well, students at UW-Madison are lucky that we have probably the strongest African languages program in the United States. We typically offer about 5 languages each year at multiple levels.
Which languages would those be typically?
Those include Arabic, Swahili, Zulu, Hausa, which is a Nigerian language, Wolof, a Senegalese language, and Yoruba, another Nigerian language. And then occasionally we're able to offer other languages as well. I believe next year they'll be starting to offer Somali for the first time. And these are all in the Department of what's now called African Cultural Studies, with support from the African Studies Program, which has Title VI funding from the Department of Education to give students funding who want to learn these languages. So I can talk more about that later if you want. But a colleague of mine and I started another program for students who want to learn other African languages, since, as we talked about at the beginning, there's way more than 5 in Africa, and especially for graduate students, we often find students who need one of these less commonly taught African languages for their research.
Give me an example of a graduate student who would need a language for a research project and not be able to get access to that language
sure.
instruction.
Yeah, so I have had one student who has finished doing research in Uganda and needed to learn Luganda, which is a major language there, for her research, which is similar to Swahili in that it's Bantu, but different enough that learning Swahili would not have helped her in the field.
And so, this would be a need so that she could talk to people there or
yes.
read material? Or
mostly talk to people. Mm-hmm. I would say, with Swahili, there is a lot of material written, so students who are learning that, or for Arabic, obviously, being able to read and write is an important skill. But for many other African languages, most students primarily need to be able to speak and listen for the kinds of research that they're doing. And in the past, like when I was a graduate student, we would only have whatever languages were offered in a traditional setting, and so many students studied a language different from the one they actually needed just to kind of get a sense of the grammar. So if they wanted to work with Luganda at that time, they would have studied Swahili and then hope that the grammar and some of the vocabulary would help them once they get into the field and they could start working with native speakers. But when I came to UW-Madison in 2013 as a faculty member, I created a new program that allows us to offer other languages to students through a self-instructional model. So it's a two-semester sequence where in the first semester, students learn how to teach themselves a language while also getting credit for starting that process.
And then, is this something that's done online or they're in a class?
It is now. When I first started, it was in a class where we call it the multi-language seminar. So we might have students studying five different languages, but they meet weekly to share ideas with one another, how to set goals, what works well and what doesn't, different resources that they find that might be useful, and so on. In 2016, I think, I went on maternity leave, and so I changed it into an online course. And now a colleague has taken over, and it's continued to work online, which was very convenient during
the pandemic, right?
Yes. But has, you know, enabled us to kind of expand the course to involve other students. And we now have a summer version as well. So through that, students can actually learn any African languages or even any language in the world. And in the summer, we've been able to specifically offer funding for students who want to use that program for either African languages or less commonly taught Southeast Asian languages.
Well, so let me imagine that I want to learn Moray, which is one of the languages that a student from Burkina Faso in my class last year spoke. How would this work? If I took a class, would I have access to audio material? Mm-hmm. Are there guides to the grammar? How would I teach myself how to speak?
Well, it depends on the language, but we have a really extensive library collection here. For most African languages, you can find at least a grammar, sometimes some pedagogical materials, dictionaries, and if you're lucky, you know, maybe other things like novels and short stories and so on. So it really depends on the language, but many of our students have been able to find lots of resources like that. The Peace Corps has produced lots of materials from many different languages in the countries where they work, so often those are a good starting point for students. And then we also encourage them and teach them how to find an expert speaker, typically a native speaker, but not necessarily. It could be a more highly advanced student or someone who has already learned the language to high levels themselves to work with as a conversation partner. We kind of try to differentiate that from a tutor. This person is not there to teach them. The emphasis is really on teaching the student how to teach themselves. So if they're able to find a conversation partner, when they meet with them, they would tell them, this is what I want to focus on. These are the things I need to learn in order to be able to do my research. And they kind of guide that process working with a conversation partner. So occasionally they're able to find those people in Madison. We do have an African Association of Madison that has speakers from all over the continent, but if they can't find someone locally, they've often been able to hire someone back in the country where the language is spoken to work with over Zoom or some other platform.
It's probably really important to have somebody you're actually talking to, because I think we've all had the experience of learning a language in a textbook and feeling like we're doing pretty well. And then getting to that country and realizing that people don't speak slowly, for one thing, and they don't speak like they do in the book. And you can feel overwhelmed in the presence of conversation in a language that you thought you knew.
Yeah, I think that's really important for students to be able to get that practice if they can. But we also, the course is designed in such a way that even if they can't find someone to work with, they can still work on the other skills and kind of get ready so that when they do go to the field, do find someone to talk with, they'll be ready to do that.
Let's listen to a sample of another language that we haven't talked about, Zulu. And then I want to talk to you about some of the special sounds that sometimes seem to be associated with certain languages. tell us what we just heard?
Sure. So that was a song called Pata Pata by Mariam Makeba, a South African artist singing in Zulu. I'm not a Zulu speaker myself, so I can't tell you about the content of the song, but it does feature a lot of the clicks that Zulu is known for. So several South African languages and probably a few in other countries are known for having click sounds. That includes the ones I'm aware of are Zulu and Xhosa, if I'm saying that right. So the name Xhosa is spelled K-H-O-S-A and X-H-O-S-A, and the X symbol indicates one of the clicks. And as far as I know, there are three different clicks in Southern African languages. One, like Xhosa, is on the side of your mouth, kind of like you're calling a horse. And then there's one on the roof of the mouth. That's, and I think the other is like what we would call a tisk in English. Like, but what I've been able to learn them in isolation like that, but what makes them really challenging is when you have to say them, for me at least, is saying them in the middle of a word or at the beginning of a word. So like also saying it as the consonant that starts the word can be challenging for a non-native speaker to learn.
Is it the kind of thing where, just the way I know, intonation can make a huge difference in some Asian languages where you can, just by the tone of your voice, saying what you think is the right thing, say a completely different, maybe obscene word? Is it the kind of thing where if you get the clicks wrong, it's laughably problematic?
I think so. I mean, as I said, I don't know any of the click languages, so I can't give you an example. But each click is a different consonant, so it would be essentially, you know, starting the word bat and saying cat instead, like, you know, obviously it has a completely different meaning.
How much of the impact of colonialism do you find when you're looking at the history of languages in Africa? I mean, it's always struck me as kind of, I don't know what the adjective is. It's sad in a way, or it makes you kind of feel outraged if you have someone from Angola speaking Portuguese, someone from, you know, Togo speaking French, someone here speaking English, and it's all kind of a testament to the colonial, just terrible behavior, taking over African countries and the riches and sort of robbing whole groups of people of their own culture, yet you can have these European languages be the official language of a country. How do you feel when you're traveling in Africa or talking to people from Africa and you hear the European languages that are kind of the remnant of colonialism?
Well, I think it's really a mixed blessing. Because, you know, as I mentioned with Swahili, it's become a lingua franca that allows people to communicate throughout this region. And to some extent, European languages have done that as well. So South Africa, for example, has, I think, 10 official languages and probably other dialects that could be considered languages but are not. And yet English has allowed people to communicate across these different languages. So it definitely serves a useful purpose. I think where it is problematic is when it has completely replaced African languages and led to some languages dying out or being on the verge of dying out because people just don't see a kind of pragmatic value in them anymore, that they need English to get a good job, for example. So in that way, it is really sad. In other ways, colonial involvement in kind of language policy and so on has, again, served a mixed blessing. So Swahili has lots of different dialects, but was not written in Roman script before colonialism. It was written for a few centuries in Arabic script. But when German and later English colonialists arrived in Tanzania, they started writing it in Roman script. And they also chose one dialect, the Zanzibari dialect, to be the basis for a standard form of the language. But they did not involve Africans in that process. So all the decisions they were making about which dialect should be the basis and, you know, how to write different words and so on, were all made by Europeans. And that has continued to cause some disagreement among African linguists about these issues. So I think, yeah, it has had some positive effects, but also some negative effects.
Well, we know language is political.
Yes.
I would think in some countries where there's so many different languages that the choice of language for a ruling party might be, you know, part of the whole choice of which party is leading, you know, sort of different factions based on who speaks what language.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, as you mentioned, a lot of countries chose to keep a European language after colonialism ended as their official or national language for purposes of unity, for allowing people across different ethnic groups to communicate, for not appearing that they are favoring one particular ethno-linguistic group over another. Tanzania is relatively unique in choosing Swahili rather than English as its national language. But that has also had some detrimental effects in that people who are native speakers of Swahili are no longer seen as an ethnic group in Tanzania by the government, even though they themselves would identify as a separate group from others. But now the government wants to claim, well, everyone is Swahili. And therefore, there is no group that, you know, has ownership over Swahili identity. And then South Africa is another unique case where they chose to have English and Afrikaans alongside indigenous languages, all as official languages. So they produce government documents multilingually and so on. So there's different models, but yeah, having a European language is definitely the most common model throughout the continent.
More on the languages of Africa when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Katie Thompson, and we are celebrating African languages. We know that in, for example, British speech, there's a big difference in the reaction someone would have to Cockney, you know, versus sort of Oxford-educated, you know, and if you think of My Fair Lady and the way language is tied into class.
Yes.
And becomes a marker of who's educated, who's in power, who's, you know. And then in terms of American English, I've seen information that said if you want to be a broadcaster, sound like you're from Kansas. And I know when Jean Ferraca was first at public radio, they tried to get her Brooklyn accent, you know, and they, not to be as apparent. And I was coached in not having Tennessee speech coming from my mother, being from Appalachia, that we have definite class markers. So someone with Southern speech is judged a certain way in this country.
Yes.
Can you talk about dialect in Africa? And I know that's a huge topic because there are dialects, you know, thousands of them. But whether there's also with the languages and dialects something equivalent where there's a judgment that can be reached with class involved.
I would say it's less about class and more about ethnicity in the parts of Africa where I've worked. So, as I mentioned, standard Swahili was based on the Zanzibari dialect, which is on the coast of Tanzania. So speakers who typically speak Swahili as their first language are kind of seen as having this prestigious variety of Swahili. Sometimes American or English writing researchers will call it the very Swahili. Whereas a lot of other speakers, you can hear influences of their first language on their Swahili pronunciation or their grammar and so on. where you find class would be more with access to English in those regions where that were former British colonies. So people who are very well educated will have learned English, or in North Africa, you might find French, or in parts of West Africa, you would find French. So people who have had enough money to go to expensive schools and so on will speak English very well. Often if you hear Nigerians, for example, Nigerian writers who have become very popular in the West, like Chimamanda Adichie, you can hear a kind of British accent in their English, or because of the kinds of schools that they went to or the kind of English that they had access to. So that is more of a class marker, I would say, than the dialect of an African language.
And let's say that you're talking to someone and you only have a brief amount of time. What would you say your argument would be for why we should learn more about African languages, learn those languages, why it's important, why does it matter?
Yeah. Well, I think Africa is probably one of the least well understood continents for Americans, that we have a lot of stereotypes and so on, and that learning a language can be a way of getting a much deeper access to the culture that we want to understand. So I think we can access some knowledge about Africa by reading, you know, literature in English or social science work in English, but we can get a much deeper knowledge if we actually can visit a place and talk to people in their language, and it shows a kind of respect that will lead to deeper relationships and deeper understanding.
What kind of misconceptions do you think most Americans have about Africa? I'm not talking about just languages, but yeah. When people talk to you, what makes you cringe?
Well, most people can't differentiate among different African countries, let alone different ethno-linguistic groups. So they think of Africa as one big place. Even on the news, often you'll hear people talk about, several different countries, they'll just say Africa rather than naming any
like a block.
Yeah.
all thinking the same
yes,
way.
Yeah. And even a lot of people talk about African culture as if it's one singular culture. I find that problematic. Thinking that with regard to languages, thinking that Africa doesn't have languages, that it only has dialects. Often people will ask me, you know, how many African dialects do you speak, or how many dialects are spoken in Africa? And I, you know, have to come back to that 2,000 languages number, or to talk about how many different languages I speak, and that each one has its own variety of dialects and so on.
I think of the scene from Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun from 1959, where she has a character from Africa as part of the play. But then there's a conversation between Benita and George about Africa, where it's clear that this notion of Africa as only having a history of grassy huts and not much else versus these ancient kingdoms and civilizations we know nothing about.
Yeah. And modern civilizations, too. I mean, Africa has some of the biggest cities and most crowded cities and traffic and so on. People don't realize they think that it's still everyone is living in villages and so on, but it's very different.
One word that gets used about Africa's tribes, and sometimes that seems to have a pejorative sense and not be appropriate to use, and other times it seems to be what you need to say. Can you fill me in on that? Because it also, I would assume, would go with discussing languages, is which tribes speak this.
Yeah. So you mentioned Harold Shoaib earlier. One thing that I learned from him when I was a graduate student was not to use the word tribe, that in African studies, we usually refer to ethnic groups rather than tribes. Or when we're talking about language, we might say linguistic groups or ethno-linguistic groups. So, yeah, I think if we take a moment to reflect on our own language use of when we would call a group a tribe and when we might call it something else, we'll see that we, you know, almost never would refer to a group of white Americans, for example, as a tribe. We have started using it to refer to Native American groups, and I'm not sure what the politics are around that, if it's more acceptable in that in those communities. But in Africa, I think, or in African studies, I should say, it does have kind of racist connotations, that it's seen that we wouldn't call other groups tribes, so why should we do that for Africa? And it's the challenging thing, though, is that many Africans who grew up under a colonial or colonial influenced education system, themselves were taught the word tribe in English and will sometimes use it. And so in African studies here, we often get graduate students from the continent who themselves have to unlearn the word tribe and think about other terms they could use, like ethnic group or ethno-linguistic group and so on.
Can you say something about the research that you're doing and that others in the department or even graduate students are doing where knowing languages becomes part of the research?
Yeah, absolutely. So my own work is on Swahili language use in coastal Tanzania. I've done projects on hip-hop in Swahili, on how Swahili women teach one another to speak appropriately.
Let's back up to that hip-hop.
Okay, sure.
So hip-hop in Swahili,
yes.
You're looking at the way hip-hop culture has come into Tanzania translating things in Swahili or doing their own version of hip-hop?
Doing their own version. So the project that I worked on that related to that was actually looking at a number of performers who draw on Maasai language and identity in their rap, which is in Swahili. So in one case, a group that had one Maasai member but would kind of perform in such a way that suggested they were all Maasai, even though many of them belong to other ethnic groups. And then in another case, a musician from the coast who was ethnically Maasai but grew up in a group that would not be visually recognized as Maasai, but in his performance took on that more visual, iconic, stereotypical representation of Maasai identity, which includes this relates to your earlier question about kind of distinctions among dialects. The Maasai within Tanzania are kind of stereotyped as not being able to speak Swahili properly. And when I interviewed him, I noticed that he could speak standard Swahili very well, but in his performance, he would kind of do this mock Maasai register of Swahili where he would mix up syllables and so on in order to perform this kind of stereotypical Maasai identity in his
But it was a deliberate choice.
Yes, yes. But and kind of perpetuating some negative stereotypes about Maasai people, but in a way that profited him in his ability to sell music.
And would this be a kind of two-way process where hip-hop in this country, influenced by African rhythms and, you know, that history, but then coming back across the ocean the other way and now influencing folks in Tanzania
yeah,
who are
absolutely.
Taking American hip-hop and then making it their own?
Yeah, it's definitely a circular process, yeah.
What are some other ways that you've looked at language use?
Another project I've worked on is on, well, you mentioned my book, Popobawa, which was about a Swahili kind of urban legend about a jinn or Islamic spirit who allegedly comes into people's homes at night while they're sleeping and sodomizes them. And so the first version of this story I was told was by a Tanzanian woman living in Los Angeles, where I taught before I came here. And she said that if this happens to you, you're meant to tell 10 people or Popobawa will come back and make you his wife. And so I was interested from a language perspective in how the story had this built-in mechanism for perpetuating itself. And so I spent a summer in Tanzania about 14 years ago now, collecting different versions of this story and looking at how people were using it to perform different functions. So sometimes it was used to identify themselves with Islam in a way of saying, like, well, this kind of thing doesn't happen to me because I and my family are good Muslims. We remember to pray and so on. And people who don't do that are the ones who are getting attacked. Other times I found that queer men were using the story to kind of identify one another. So they would joke around and say, the Popobawa visited me last night. And if they got a positive reaction, that could be a way of coming out to someone. Whereas if they got a negative reaction, they could say, oh, I'm just joking around. And I found that Swahili women were able to use the story to kind of strategically move past some limits on what they're normally allowed to talk about in terms of sexuality and gender and so on.
Have you ever run up against kind of opposition to what you're doing from the speakers? Like, in other words, or is it that the research isn't as widely known there as I guess what I'm looking at is whether there's a sort of protective reaction about, you know, what are you doing studying this language that's not yours? And
no, not at all. People, I think, are very, I don't know if impressed is the right word, but kind of surprised to find an outsider who has spent so much time learning Swahili and become so proficient. And they do see that as a sign of respect. And
I would think so, then. Yeah. And sort of a validation that this language has worth.
Yeah. So I've found people very welcoming, very interested in talking with me, especially when I was doing the project on Popobau. I think people were surprised that this story had reached all the way to the U.S. and that it was kind of fun to talk about. So most people were very willing to chat with me.
I've learned such a great deal about African languages and realizing how little most of us know about the just incredible variety and diversity of speech that exists in Africa. Thank you for being my guest.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed talking with you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.
Kwa wageni na wanyeji Mimi Masai bana Nasema mimi Masai Nadumisha mila Ile wangine lisha shindu Mimi Masai bana Nasema mimi Masai Ramaduni yenye nguvu liobaki Afrika Pigia mimi simu mesha nunu motibel Au pigia foko daulisia ule molel Mutu ingine nasema Masai waduduni Awesi amini sasa na biri sendi fani Mpa mimi bia ile naitwa kibokoli Au ndugu wake foma goldi baridi Natangaswa sana nalewesha saidi Na hapa saradalama ni wapi naitwa bise Ukitafuta mtu naambiwa yuko bise Uko bise ni wapi mbona mimi bado fika Nasikia bise tu na maka nakatika Kweli saradalama watoto naharibuka Au kopi marasi napenda kurukaruka Unajirusha sana na mwisho mutaanguka Shuka sima motoka takuja kuumboka Jana mekwenda kunywa soda kwa hoteli Soda liletwa nikaweka kwa kibakuli Nikaoncha Na hiku sugari kamili Nikataka niongese hata kijiko mbili Au kijiko moja isiwe kama asali Ati watu nasema Masai mushamba kweli Soda bila sugari na bado nauswa gali Napewa chupa moja inauswa miambili Soda kama maji bado mejaa makadi Chungu kama ngorotik munauswa makusudi Ati munasema nikilabu soda Mimu Masai bana nasema mimu Masai Nikitu najifunia Masai fahari yangu Mimu Masai bana nasema mimu Masai Naruhusu kushangaa kwa wageni na wanyeji Mimu Masai bana nasema mimu Masai Nadumisha mila ile wangine lisha shindu Mimu Masai bana nasema mimu Masai Ramaduni yenye nguvu liobaki Afrika Professor Ludiko Bagosi Vakaya Emmanuel Limodiga Ranga bado jalala wafani Yo, vale kisanda le mungu